Welcome to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West, dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Of course they were. Of course. Is there any doubt?
I don't want those dinky lawyers.
Welcome to another edition of Emil Franzing's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander with you, along with Bunker de France.
Yep.
And on an island someplace in West Hollywood is Todd Roberts.
Yes, gentlemen, I'm here. I'm in an inner tube, and I was floating earlier down Santa Monica Boulevard, but I was able to grab hold of the hand of someone on a bus stop, and they stopped me. And then Noah came in with a lariat and roped me and brought me home. But another great day here in the city of Los Angeles under the mentorship, tutelage, and supervision of the amazing Karen Bass, our esteemed mayor, who is just constantly thinking of everyone in this city to fulfill their dreams and hopes and fantasies. There that's quote unquote what she said the other day.
Yeah.
May West for everyone.
Yeah, right, huh? All right, we got us a good program scheduled for today. Our guest is Will Emmerich. He's a living historian at the Museum of the Great Plains in Lawton, Oklahoma, and we'll have him on here in just a moment, but do you want to do an abbreviated?
Well, you know, normally at this time, coming to you from Bunker's Bunkhouse would be the good, the bad, and the bovine. But unfortunately, my notes and all of that good stuff must have been in my other jeans, and the dog ate the jeans, and so all I've got is just a little short abbreviated thing. On July 16, 18-something, Glenn Strange was born, better known to a lot of the cowboys in the picture business as Pee-wee, and brother and cousin to Cactus Mac, another movie cowboy.
And
he was born on that day.
Also, also a relative of... he wasn't a relative.
One of the Ohacos.
Well, yeah, no.
Rex Allen.
His
cousin of Rex Allen.
Yeah.
A very talented family. And also on that day, a good friend of mine, a movie stuntman, Jeff Ohaco, he came into the world. And Jeff is a very special person in my life. Him and his brother Danny and Kathy, when I was working in California, we were kind of like a family, and I really appreciated the time I had with them out there. But Jeff has gone on to become quite an accomplished horseman. And I use the term horseman in the sense of the highest acclamation you can give somebody in the horse world,
mm-hmm.
not just somebody that rides a horse in Central Park. Jeff, he went out of his way to search out people that were experts in the fields, doctoring, stuff like that. He became a farrier, a highly qualified farrier with specializations. He also now has a place out there, and he teaches clinics, horseman clinics, and it goes home to the ranch every year. That's up in Winslow, the Chevron Butte Cattle Company out of Winslow, and the whole family gathers up. They do the spring roundups, the fall roundups, and it's just ranching. And I've milked the bovine about as much as I can, so we're going to turn it on back to Harry and our guests.
You forgot either July 14 or 15, I can't remember which day it was, when Pat Garrett allegedly shot Billy the Kid.
That's what they say.
I said allegedly.
I'm going along with you. I'm following the fool. I just want to say one thing about two things about that. At the time that the alleged murder took place, there was also another Billy the Kid up there in town. And I who knows? I think maybe Garrett might have shot the wrong man and just tried to cover up, because basically he was shot in the dark without a chance, and if it wasn't the kid, it would be manslaughter at least.
Well, if you watch the movie Henry, that will help out some.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil it.
You know, and they always say you can't dig up the body because three of them are buried there. Well, but still, even with three different DNAs all mixed together, there would be a certain continuous
You think pattern. So.
Yeah.
All right. Will Emmerich is our guest. Will, welcome to Voices of the West.
Confusion of the West.
Howdy, everybody. I'm glad to be here.
We appreciate it. You have a job that I love when I was doing it. As a living historian, a living history interpreter at the Museum of the Great Plains there in Lawton, give us a rundown of what kind of things folks can see when they come to the museum.
Well, the first thing they're going to see is the newly rebuilt Coffey's Trading Post. Coffey's Trading Post was a fur trading post that was built in 1835 by Holland Coffey and Silas Colville, two young businessmen from the Fort Smith, Arkansas territory. They put together an expedition in 1835 to go up the Red River and establish trade with Comanche and Kiowa. They ended up building their trading post at the mouth of Cache Creek. So what we have is a replica of that trading post.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to come in through the side gate. You're going to see the corral first thing when you come in. There is a corral inside on the west wall of the trading post. Then you will come into the trade house itself, where we have furs hanging, everything from flint hide, buffalo hides, wolf hides, bear hides, every other little fur in between, a lot of beaver hides.
Gophers.
We have trade goods hanging on the wall, traps, firearms, a little bit of everything in there. Outside, we have the bunkhouse cabin. We have the forge. We have the powder keg room. And then, of course, there is a blockhouse on each corner. And it is built to where you can go up in the top of the blockhouse on the southwest corner and see how the living quarters and stuff were there. So when you walk through those gates, you're walking back into the 1830s.
So tell me now, that didn't start out as a Starbucks, right?
No, that did not start out as a Starbucks. It's actually our second replica that we've had there at the museum. The first one was built back in 1983. And when they built it then, they made it out of old green telephone poles. They had great living history programs there for 40 years. They really did. They had great living history interpreters there over the years. But the weather in Oklahoma, after 40 years, it just started to make the thing fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
The logs were rotten. And so here about 4.5 years ago, they tore down the whole thing. And a great friend of mine, Bill Bailey, out of Colorado, came down and rebuilt that trading post. It took him 3.5 years to get it done. He finished it up last June, and we reopened it for history programs in August of last year when I started there.
Hmm. Wow.
Now, did he use power tools, or he do it the old way with a hatchet?
A lot of it he stuck to the old methods of doing it. The logs all came from Colorado.
Made his own nails, did he?
No. He has got wooden square pegs holding most of it together.
Ah,
even the floor
tongue and groove
is held down by wooden pegs.
Wow.
That's the way my granddad used to build. He was a hell of a carpenter.
You know, and you didn't need any kind of permitting back then.
Oh, yeah,
you just build it.
Much better. You know.
No, not at all.
All
the
right.
Actual site, I'm sorry, I was going to say the actual site of the trading post was down on the Red River. It sat about a half mile up off of the Red and about 400 yards to the east of Cache Creek.
Hmm.
So open prairie where it was set at, but with a lot of heavy timber down on the river and the creek alongside of it.
Do you have to worry about tornadoes? Isn't Lawton in Tornado Alley?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, of course, that's always a possibility. But so far, we've been blessed and fortunate that we have not had that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that we never do have to deal with that.
Indeed.
But yes, that's
indeed.
A lot of the bad weather seems to go north and south of Lawton.
Okay. We like that.
You know, one of the things you do there, and I got, when I was doing my research on it, I went down the rabbit hole of your film Friday, and I spent a couple of good hours just looking at some of those old photographs and stuff and studying them. And maybe you could comment a little bit on some of your photo collection.
Well, the photo collection we have in the archives, what you've seen is just a fraction of it. They have a lot of early stuff from what was then considered Indian territory all the way up and through the Lawton's founding, which this is coming up here in a couple weeks as we're going to be celebrating Lawton's birthday.
1901.
Which, yeah. They are working at digitalizing all of the photographs right Ooh. Now to get them onto our website so that people will be able to access the entire collection.
Will they be doing them chronologically or
I'm not sure exactly because that's not my department,
oh, okay.
but I do know that they have everything from Lawton's founding to all the way back into a lot of old cowboy photos and things like that that will eventually be available to the public to view through our website.
Yeah, I saw one photo. It was a 1951 soda shop, so it covers a lot of ground.
Yes. Yep, it sure does. But the museum itself is actually going to be closing in the middle of next month for repairs. It's going to probably be closed for about a year and a half or so. So the staff, the inside staff of the museum is going to be processing all of those photos, and that's what they're going to be doing while the construction's going on.
Well, you still have
my
a job?
My part is going to... Yes, my part's going to stay open. We're going to keep the trading post open, and we're still going to continue to do history programming and things like that. Try to keep things interesting for everybody. We enjoy having the visitors come in. I've got people all the way from Japan and Germany and France, South Africa. I've had folks from all over. And I haven't sent anybody away with a bad experience yet.
Good. Todd Roberts, get in there.
So, you know, Will, you're however old you are, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there, and you're running around the neighborhood with the kids and you're all your friends, and somebody says, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? And you go, well, I want to be a cowboy and a mountain man and a fur trapper and a settler and so on. And you know, or your mom asked you or your grandmother asked you, and then they think, he'll grow out of that. But you didn't grow out of it. Now, you're talking to three guys who, by the way, also didn't grow out of it. But where did that start, and what was the arc in its progression?
Prematurely immature.
Well, first of all, I will be 62 tomorrow.
Baby. Yeah, happy
so,
birthday.
God bless you. Happy birthday.
But I got started. I used to be, back when I was in my teenage years, I was in the Royal Rangers, which is part of the Assemblies of God Church.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a program called the Frontiersman Camping Fraternity.
Ooh.
And which I never got into that, but my friends that were in Rangers with me got in, and it sparked my interest. Of course, you know, I grew up in the time when Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and the TV shows and things like that were still on, so I always had a love of history. But I attended my first Mountain Man Rendezvous in 1983, and I was wearing a buckskin suit that I had bought off of somebody that was about five or six sizes too big, and I just enjoyed the heck out of it, and I have been going ever since. So 43 years now of living history. The Mountain Man stuff drew me into horses because, of course, the Mountain Man was a mounted man. And then once I got into horses, then I got into cowboying. And the cowboying got me into other aspects of history throughout the Victorian era and into gold mining, California gold miner, doing civilian impressions of the 1850s. I belong to a club now down south of Fort Worth that we have an entire Old West town. It's a private club. We get together every 2 months. And when the bell rings at 7 o'clock on Friday night, you're in the 1880s. I drive stagecoach when I go down there. I'm going to be going down not this weekend, but the next weekend. Mm-hmm. And we have our Grand Gamblers Jubilee, which I've wanted a couple of times, and I've placed several times. So I'm going to go down there and try to win another tournament. But we go until Sunday at noon, then the bell rings and everybody gets back in their 21st century clothes, gets in their cars and goes home. But we have saloons and hotels and everything.
So now, did you drive four ups or six ups or what?
I drive just two, pulling the stagecoach.
Oh, just the two.
Because yeah, I bring my...
That's more of a town coach then. Yeah.
So no cell phones, no watches...
The only watch you can wear your pocket watch.
Yep.
But there is also a prize for whoever does the stupidest thing during the weekend. It's called the 215 watch. Of course, it's broke and doesn't work. But it says it's at 215. So if anybody asks you what time it is, you're required to pull that out of your pocket and say, "Why, it's 215."
Well, you needed one of those wrist sundials.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's clever.
Or a pocket sundial, I guess.
Yeah, you could use one of those, too.
I've actually got a compass sundial that I keep in one of my shooting pouches.
All right. We got to do our first commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Will Emmerich is our guest. He's the living history interpreter for the Museum of the Great Plains. Job I would love to have. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts. We'll be right back after these messages.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the hacienda. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away, it'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club is one of the best-kept economic secrets in town. This 900-member group maintains one of the finest shotgun shooting ranges in the country, featuring trap, skeet, five-stand, and sporting clays fields, and hosts national and international events that bring thousands of people and millions of dollars into our community. The Spring Satellite Grand American Tournament alone involves 1,200 participants for 10 days. Learn more about this and their other contributions to our community at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com.
You know, it's a splendid gesture on your part, donating your entire estate to the people of Tumbleweed.
No, why shouldn't I? These people are my friends. And besides, well, I've always had jackrabbits in my boots. And I've got to keep moving.
This is the Voices of the West.
Old Bow-Legged Jones, he looks like he's got rubber bones. His hair's always shaggy, his whiskers grow like moss. His clothes are always baggy, he's a total loss. Mother Nature must have made his legs to fit a horse. Old Bow-Legged John.
We're back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West, Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, and Todd Roberts somewhere on an island in West Hollywood.
Yes, indeed.
Snorkeling.
Right. Our guest is Will Emmerich. He's a living history interpreter at the Museum of the Great Plains. Man, you got the job. I used to do living history, and I just absolutely loved it. What is it, when you do your living history presentation, is there a model that you follow, or is it kind of ad lib?
Well, it's all ad lib. I have certain information that I want to get out there, but I try to keep the presentations like less than 10 minutes because people, they want entertained more than they want educated.
Yeah.
So I try to make it fun. One of the things that I do is I take them out to the forge, and I'll normally make something for them, either an S-hook or a screwdriver or something like that, uh-huh, that they can take home with them. On Saturdays, we have what I call our trade days, and I leave furs up at the front desk, and kids can pick them up and bring them down to the trading post, and I teach them how to barter, and they can get a string of glass beads, or I'll make them something on the forge whenever they bring it down to give them an example of how the trading post actually worked. So, you know, I try to keep it interesting for folks. We try to throw in information on how fires were made, the types of firearms and how they were done, the beaver trapping and everything like that. But you have to kind of model it to each individual.
Sure.
Because there's some folks who want to spend some time and they want to learn. And then there's other folks who just kind of want to walk through. And you mm-hmm. have to learn to read that so that you're not boring them, I guess is the best thing to say.
So is
so how do you...
Go ahead, Todd.
I was just going to say, Will, how do you get rid of that 9-year-old boy who just won't go away and keeps talking and talking and talking, and no matter what you answer his question with, he has another question?
Well, they have
sounds like Todd is a kid.
Yeah, they have a drawer for that, those kids.
I'm self-projecting when I was a child.
I actually try to take kids like that and get them to where they're doing something, or uh-huh. I'm showing them something that uh-huh. entertains them.
Yep.
That they, you know, and I don't mind the questions. That's what I'm there for.
Sure.
You know, I love sharing history.
Yep.
And, I mean, you'll have the occasional one that, you know, you're not going to be able to get them to calm down or anything like that. But you just have to kind of roll with that because people are people. You know, if you want to reach people and share history with them, you've got to take the good with the bad and try to make the whole experience something that they're going to remember.
You know, I would suggest what you do, you should have a mud puddle there. And when you get one of those kids like that, you give him a stick and you say, beat the mud puddle. And he'll be so happy. And I'll be out of your hair.
Well, we have prairie dogs all over, and we have rabbits inside of the trading post.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times the kids will chase them. But I've also got a fur press in there. It's the fulcrum type, and if kids are misbehaving, I tell them it's a catapult, and that we toss them out of the trading post, and nobody's been able to clear the wall as of yet.
All them greasy spots on the wall.
Well, do you ever feel a little tempted, or you feel like you're having a flashback to W.C. Fields when he says, go away, kid, you bother me.
No, I enjoy the kids. You know, when you make them something or when they learn something, you see the smile on their face.
Yeah,
and
kids
are appreciative.
Totally worth it. You know,
yep.
Living history has given me so much over the years,
yeah.
And it is just an absolute joy to be able to give back and pass on what little knowledge I know to others. and to see their faces light up and things like that. It's just great.
So the difference between a reenactor and a living historian, what do you think, Will?
Well, reenactors, by definition, reenact certain events. Civil War, Revolutionary War, French and Indian War, things like that. But as far as living history goes, we are interpreting the people of the past. So we are wearing, of course, the clothing, have the accoutrements and everything like that. And ours is more for education. It's more of a one-on-one thing, whereas the reenactment is more of a group thing that, you know, you are acting out a certain battle here or a certain event and things like that. But you have to be kind of, you know, they're kind of interchangeable because there are certain times when we are reenacting certain events. And then there's times where we're just giving people that glimpse into how people lived 191 years ago or 200 years ago. And to see the differences on, you know, how good we have it now. You know, people ask me all the time, do you think you could live in the 19th century? And I tell them, yes, I've got the skills to live in the 19th century. I can hunt, trap, I know my horses and mules and things like that. But I really like penicillin and I like ibuprofen.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Todd is a reenactor. He reenacts Saturday night at the Long Branch all the time.
Both of us.
Well, everybody's got their niche, you know.
I might take it a little too far, but I'm never ever the drunk on Tombstone on
Gunsmoke. Louis Feeders.
Louis Feeders. Never a Louis Feeders. You know, I try not to be. I'm definitely not one of those overly pawy cowboys. You know,
you've never misbehaved with Miss Kitty.
He's been slapped.
I went through my wild times as a cowboy working on ranches and feedlots. Yeah.
Well,
before we went to the break, you were talking about putting something in your shooting bag, which makes us think there's some firearms involved in all of this.
Black powder.
And Harry is fanatic on black powder. If it's black powder, he'll buy it and shoot it.
You've got it.
He just got a shotgun, by the way.
Right.
Well, definitely. We have, in the trading post, we have two replicas of Bartlett Northwest trade guns, which, of course, you know, Hudson's Bay started marketing them in about the 1760s or so, and they were made specifically for the Native American trade. You know, they're a smooth bore. You can fire shot or ball out of it. You can fire sticks and stones out of it. But, you know, they're a pretty decent gun. But, you know, of course, they were only back in the settlements, only about a $4.50 gun, but you're going to pay three or four times that back in the trading post. Yep. But we have Lehman trade rifles, we have a couple of Lancaster rifles, and then I have my collection of rifles that I usually take one with me every day and a pistol to match. And so, you know, we talk a lot about the firearms and stuff like that. I've even got a couple of signal cannons at the trade.
Oh, Harry just perked up.
Yeah, I know. I've got a signal cannon I bought. Haven't shot it yet. I wanted to shoot it during the 4th of July celebrations that Bunker and I went to, where a friend of ours reads the Declaration of Independence. And, well, everybody does. Everybody has a chance to. And so I cruise up there and said, I brought some little friends to help. And he's a firearms guy, and he said, maybe we shouldn't do that. And I said, it's okay to ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah, when we fire off any kind of firearm at the trading post, I call the city of Lawton's police department beforehand because we are right in Elmas Thomas Park. There is a water park right across the road from us. They start hearing gunfire and people are going to panic.
So you've got black powder rifles, black powder revolvers, The flintlocks, the rifles?
Yeah, well, I've got both percussion and flintlock.
Okay.
You know, of course, the only revolver that was out in the 1830s was the Patterson, which we don't have one at the trading post. I have all single-shot weapons, with the exception of double-barrel shotgun, there percussion shotgun that we keep in the bunkhouse.
Nice.
But, you know, people ask about them all the time, and kids are amazed to see how they're loaded and how they work and stuff. Whenever you pull the trigger on a flintlock, even though it's not loaded, when they see those sparks, you know, it's a wow factor for them.
And, you know,
and then usually I'll lead off of that and take them outside and show them how flint and steel works to make fire. And sometimes I'll take the one of the trade guns out there and I'll start a fire with the lock on the trade gun.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, those early guns, those were work of arts when you think about it, because they were handmade. There wasn't an armory back there cranking them out.
Well, there was a Springfield armory, and Colt was getting
when,
his.
When did the Springfield armory start to?
I'm not sure. Early 1800s, I believe.
I didn't realize it was that old.
And Colt was starting things going in the 1830s.
Like the flintlocks and stuff like that. Predating that.
Yeah. Well, most
there
of the...
Was a, I was going to say there was a lot of individual gun makers applied to the first brigades and stuff like that. J. Henry out of Bolton, Pennsylvania, made the J. Henry Lancaster and English pattern and scroll guard pattern rifles. Of course, Hawken in St. Louis was selling rifles. They actually did more gun work and repairs for, like, the American Fur Company than what they actually sold to them. You know, the Hawken was a gun that was expensive. It was $27.50 back in the 1830s, which, if you take into consideration that average wages were 43 cents a day, then it wasn't just the average Joe that was carrying around a Hawken rifle. Did they make it to Rendezvous? Yeah, probably in the Fur Brigade leaders and the traders who were coming out of St. Louis probably might have carried a Hawken rifle. They could resupply it with percussion caps and things like that, but the average trapper wasn't going to spend that kind of money. They became more popular in the 1840s and the 1850s than what they were during the heyday of the fur trade between 1820 and 1840.
Do you get into the indigenous fur trade with the post?
We talk about it because, of course, the vast majority of the customers that came to Coffey's Trading Post were the Comanche and the Kiowa and the Caddos and the Wichitas. And, you know, and I talked to people letting them know that Coffey and Colville took the time to learn the culture of the Comanche and Kiowa, and they learned their language. They got along with them great. They couldn't get along with their own fellow citizens that well, but they got along with the Native Americans pretty good. But they did take precautions. You know, we have a window, a trade window, on the one gate of the trade house. And I let folks know that, you know, hey, if you had 100 warriors attack the trading post, which it was never attacked, from those blockhouses, you could defend it. But if you allowed, you know, 25 warriors within the walls, then if they decided that, you know, that, hey, you've got really great trade goods, we think we'll take them, there's nothing you could do to stop them. You'd be overwhelmed quickly. So they took precautions. Yeah. They did most of the trade through that window on the gate. But they would, of course, bring in, you know, the chief and his family and wine and dine them. They would set kind of what the prices for buffalo and beaver and things like that were going to be. They had four Delaware Indian hunters that stayed in the bunkhouse that would actually go out every day and hunt for buffalo and deer and elk and things like that to keep the place supplied in meat, and also to add to the growing pile of hides and furs that were coming into the trading post. So you can't talk about the fur trade without bringing in the indigenous people, because they made up the vast majority of it.
Sure, right. Now another.
So
question.
Who will was Go the ahead. The Indians were bringing in the fur trade, and who was then the other customer of the fur trade? In other words, when the buffalo hides and the elk hides and the wolf hides and so on came in, who were the traders selling them to or trading those to?
They would have brokers back in Fort Smith. That's where they were based out of Fort Smith. Those men then, you know, Coffee and Colville and Company were comprised of Holland Coffee, Silas Colville, and then their third partner was James Randolph, who stayed back in Fort Smith. So when they would bring the furs that four-week trip back to Fort Smith, they would immediately go to their place of business there, and then Randolph would work at selling the furs and hides off to brokers. And then from there, a lot of them went all the way down to the Gulf, were put on a ship, and like a lot of the buffalo hides were sent to England to tanneries and then turned into conveyor belts and drive belts from there.
Wow.
People don't realize that there was... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I was going to say that a lot of people don't realize that there was a huge shortage of leather in Europe at that time period, and their factories ran off of leather belts that moved the parts of the machine and moved things around in the buildings, and the buffalo filled that niche for them. So there was a huge demand starting in the early 1830s and all the way up until, you know, 1882, when the last of the big herds was killed off.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo hide leather was in demand.
There's a good...
When it was being carted to Fort Smith, was that by wagon or by boat, by river? And if it was, they had to have had an army of guys to protect it.
It was actually everything that was brought in and out of Coffee's trading post was brought in on horse or mule. The Red River was full and clogged of what they called back then rafts, what we would call log jams. There was one log jam that was over 100 miles long.
Yeah,
even today, unless the Red River is in flood stage, it's not that great to even canoe on, let alone try to take a keelboat or anything of that size up it. So that was out. The trail coming from Fort Smith, even though as the crow flies, it was only about 290 miles, but they went due south, hit the Red River, and then followed the winding Red River up to the trading post. It was coming through the cross timbers. The cross timbers was thickly forested, so they couldn't bring wagons either. The trail just wasn't there for wagons.
Wow.
So they obviously armed well.
Definitely. They would be armed well. And, you know, they would have to take precautions on the trail. But
yeah, here's an interesting footnote. Last year, it was on PBS, the last buffalo conveyor belt in one of the mills in England was taken away and converted. And it was a 50-foot belt.
Wow.
But that's so amazing because they talked about the endurance of those leather belts from the buffalo hides that literally fueled the mills in England.
Wow, that's interesting.
Well, what they would do is actually use two layers of the buffalo and then sandwich in between it a layer of canvas so that you would have these pretty thick belts.
Yeah.
That was a mixture of two buffalo hides and then the canvas, and they were pretty strong.
Hmm. Okay, we got to do our next commercial break. We're a little bit over that, but that's okay. Hey, we're having fun here. Will Emmerich is our guest, living history interpreter at the Museum of the Great Plains. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts, on The Voices of the West.
Can you even imagine switching back to pen and paper to run your business? Every year, we become more and more dependent upon our technology. If your network is not set up properly, you're just one click or one email away from losing data critical to your operation. Arizona Computer Guru offers a host of services to prevent and protect you from disaster. From online backup services to email filtering to fully managed network services, Arizona Computer Guru is here to keep your network secure, your data safe, and your budget in the black. To schedule your free consultation, call 304-8300.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club dates from 1948 and is now at 7800 West Ole Ajo Highway. The club owns 80 acres and leases 300 more from Pima County that supports 50 trap fields, 15 skeet fields, 2 5-stand fields, 2 sporting plays courses with 12 stations each, a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, 200 full-service RV hookups for members, and free Wi-Fi. This expansive facility gives enough room to host major national and international events annually, bringing thousands of people to the community. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSki.com.
Cannonball, what's happened? Another holdup, Jeff.
Anybody hurt?
Yes, ma'am. Two of the gun guards got winged. Them road agents took everything this time. They took the wagon train and all.
Got any idea who did it?
Got any idea? Sure, I recognize that dirty Lightning Barlow.
Was the train stopped with explosions?
With explosion, I thought I was back in the Civil War.
This is the Voices of the West.
On Ambo Francie's Voices of the West, Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts in the Los Angeles area. Our guest is Will Emmerich. He's a living history interpreter at the Museum of the Great Plains. And I play the theme there. I hope you recognize that is the theme to the High Chaparral. And the reason for that, Mr. de France was in 52 episodes, or three or four episodes of High Chaparral whilst it was on television. And every now and then, if you watch one, you can see him. He's not looking at the camera.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of historically reenacting, while it wasn't historically accurate, it was probably the most accurate portrayal of ranches and ranching life in that era.
Will, you mentioned the rendezvous, and talk about what that rendezvous entails.
Well, of course, the original ones, they would set a specific date and place for the traders from back east, which General Ashley was the first one to start doing it. I believe that the first rendezvous was in the early 1820s. He would bring the trade goods out from St. Louis and meet the mountain men in the mountains, and he would trade them the beaver that they brought for the goods he brought. And, of course, you know, they put mountain prices on it, just kind of like at the trading post. Everything in the trading post was marked up anywhere from 100% to 500% back in the settlements. But he found that the men would rather stay in the mountains rather than come to back into St. Louis. They were happy living there. So the rendezvous system started up after Ashley got out of it. Of course, he sold off to Jackson, Smith, and Sublette, and they did the supplying. Then they were bought out by Rocky Mountain Fur Company, which was Bridger and Fitzpatrick and Frapp and Milton Sublette, but Bill Sublette brought the supplies out yet. They were contracted under him. So the last rendezvous was held in 1840, but really it was the one time a year that these guys could have a big blow-up. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you talk about partying hard. These guys had 2 weeks out of the year to drink and to cavort with the Native American women and to just see people they hadn't seen for a long time, or to mourn people that didn't show up in this year's rendezvous. So it was the party of the West.
And they brought their own moonshine, I bet.
Here's a question for you.
Well, they brought Trader's whiskey. Of course, you know, a lot of the mountain trading houses and stuff like that would bring different types, but technically it was illegal at that time period to bring alcohol into what was considered Indian territory. So they were allowed a certain amount to be able to bring for their boatmen, which, you know, they stopped really doing the keel boats and things like that after the Rickery kind of shut them down on the river. So they were going overland, but Sublette would bring in tons of alcohol for his rivermen that didn't exist. And whenever they would get to the rendezvous, they would stop, fill up some empty barrels about three quarters of the way full of river water, dump in some alcohol, put molasses and tobacco in it to give it a little color and flavor, and then they'd put some red peppers in it so it would still have a little bite when you drank it. The universal price for whiskey throughout pretty much the West during that time period was $2 a pint.
Whoa.
They initially spent 20 cents per gallon for pure grain alcohol. So they stretched it a wee bit.
Yeah, I bet, huh?
Now, let me ask you this. Going up into Canada, the Northwest Territories, the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company, do you ever get into any of their shenanigans and stuff? Because that's an important part of the Canadian history.
I don't, but I do talk about Hudson's Bay Company because of all the fur companies that was out there, Hudson's Bay was the only company that actually regulated the amount of beaver you could take out of a certain area. They had the foresight to understand that if you trapped over 30% of the beaver population, it takes a couple of years for them to come back. Beaver are probably the least prolific breeders of all the rodent family. They don't start breeding until they're 2 years old. They only have one litter a year and only 2 to 4 kits per year. So when you've trapped them heavy, they can't come back. So Hudson's Bay, the only place that they trapped areas out was where their territory butted up against what was considered the United States territory. And what they wanted to do was create a beaver desert there so that when the Americans would come up and start to get into their territory, they would be like, well, hey, there's no beaver here. Let's turn around and go back the way we came.
Those wily Canadians.
Really, though, that was pretty forward-thinking for the 1830s.
Well, let me ask you another thing. You know, the voyeurs, you know, the French traders that really established all of the early fur trade up in Canada and down on the lower Mississippi, do you get into any of their history?
I don't a whole lot, but you can't really talk about the fur trade without them. Even before Holland Coffee and Silas Colville went up the Red River, the French were all over for a couple hundred years of what we consider Indian territory, or what is now Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. A lot of the towns and things like that are French names. A trader by the name of Chouteau in 1837 built a trading post just to the southwest of where Lawton is now. So they were all over the fur trade country. You know, they really kind of set the standard for it.
And they were mostly Mestizo, so it's some French mixed in.
Yes.
Okay, we need to take our last commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts with you. Our guest, Will Emmerich, living historian at the Museum of the Great Plains. We'll be back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's
777-1911. Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
No doubt you've heard about rescue groups for dogs and cats. But did you know there's a rescue group for horses? That's right, it's called Horse It Around Rescue. Founders Steve Boyce and Teresa Worrell are helping out all those equine victims of neglect and cruelty by giving them a place to restore their health and wellness. And Horse It Around provides a nurturing and natural environment where horses can be horses, so they can be adopted out into forever homes. More than 120 horses, mules, and donkeys have been adopted out, but like everything else, it costs money to run the project. Horse It Around is a 501c3 nonprofit located in Southeast Arizona. Your tax-deductible donations to Horse It Around will go a long way so those horses can be horses. Check out the website, horseitaroundrescue.org. Make a difference in a horse's life. That's horseitaroundrescue.org.
Besides bringing millions a year into this community with national and international events, the Tucson Trap and Skeet Club at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway services the local shooting sports community with a 380-acre site featuring trap, skeet, five stand, and two sporting clays fields, as well as a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, which all is available to local shooters, and soon, an archery range. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com or take a drive out west of town and see it for yourself. New members or single-day use, welcome.
Where's Miss Cameron? I don't know what you're talking about. Who are you, anyway?
The name is Bill Saunders. Some folks call me Wild Bill. But I'm a peaceable man.
Now then, tell your friends to come out with their hands in the air. Before I burn a brand on you with this iron.
This is the Voices of the West.
Riding down to Santa Fe, just beyond the mountains and across the way. See that sun hang low in the west, o'er the land I'm loving the best. Here we go, my old Pinto. Gotta see a preacher about a gal. So let's burn the trail and yonder we'll go. Riding down the Santa Fe.
Ah, the great Johnny Bond there. Welcome back to Emil Franzi's Voices of the West, Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts on an island somewhere in Los Angeles. Our guest is Will Emmerich, living historian at the Museum of the Great Plains in Lawton, Oklahoma.
You know, that music made me think, there's a question we haven't touched on.
Uh-huh.
What did they do for music at the fort, and maybe dancing and stuff like
yeah
that.
What's did anybody have a harmonica or fiddle or guitar
fiddles
any of these?
Were brought out.
Okay.
The jaw harp.
Yep.
Those were pretty popular. We actually have some hanging in the thing.
Cool.
The only thing I can do with it is chip my teeth. I was talented growing up. I learned how to play a cassette player, and that's
there
the only
go.
Instrument that I was ever able to really.
And there was a lot of cassette players back then.
I know, huh? That's great.
But, they would use spoons, they would use the squeeze boxes and things like that. Uh-huh. Some of the men carried that type of thing with them.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, you know, these guys were living hand to mouth, mm-hmm. and you could lose everything you had at one river crossing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they listened to music and played music when they could, but they had to learn to live without it a lot of times.
And there was an etiquette on picking your partner, like sticking a handkerchief someplace or something like that, right?
Yeah, and that went all the way up in through the cowboy times.
Yes.
They would, somebody would play the part of the gal.
But only through the dancing part.
Yeah, right.
None of that going out and holding hands.
No sparking.
Yep, that is another talent that I never learned.
Yeah,
you can ask
goodness.
My wife. I cannot dance. I can shoe horses, drive teams, pack mules. I can do beadwork, and I can do a lot of things, but I cannot dance.
Well, it's good, because if you're perfect in everything, you know, you'd be boring.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Time for a little bit of shameless promotion here, Will. What you got coming up with the museum? You mentioned it's going to be closing shortly for construction purposes. And so go ahead.
Well, August the 8th, it is going to be our celebration of Lawton's birthday. So I am going to have my chuck wagon and cowboy camp set up. So I'll be probably serving coffee and donuts in the morning. Then I'll have a pot of beans going throughout the day.
What kind of chuck wagon do you have?
I have an 1890 to right around 1900 McCormick Deering wagon that I restored about 17 years or so ago.
Wow.
I turned
awesome.
Into a chuck wagon from an old farm wagon. And so I do chuck wagon catering and things like that, but I enjoy the history of it more than I like the actual cooking. I'm one of those type of people that frets over how the food tastes and stuff like that. People will come up and say, you know, that is the best chicken fried steak I've ever had in my life, and I'll taste it, and I'm like, eh.
Yeah, okay.
You know, how's your cobbler?
You haven't eaten too many places.
Yeah, how's the cobbler?
Yeah, if you can't make good cobbler, give
up. Cobbler and berry cobblers and things like that, so...
Do you know...
Whenever I was... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, do you know Chef Kent Rollins? Cowboy Kent Rollins?
I've met Kent a few times, him and his wife.
Yeah.
Wonderful people,
and
he has done such a great job of bringing the chuck wagon to the forefront of people's minds. I've got some great friends that are chuck wagon cooks. From the wagon, John Bitt Pruitt, he does cooking schools and things like that.
Yeah.
He is cooking for the Scenic Railway down in southern Colorado now, and just does... excellent job of promoting the chuck wagon and the cowboy lifestyle. That people like that keep the West alive.
Yeah, Kent's been on the show a couple of times, and his chuck wagon is 1872 or 3 Studebaker, I believe.
Yes.
So, anyway, all right, Todd Roberts, it's time for the final question
of the day.
Well, Will, we've come to the point in the show. Or if you've been having a nice time and enjoying yourself, it's going to stop.
It's over.
It's over. Okay, so I hope you're sitting down or at least have your back brace on, because there's a lot of pressure in this question.
A lot of
pressure. Yeah, a strong drink helps. Your favorite film or television Western?
Wow. Yeah, that is a tough one.
Do you hear the drums in the background?
I've got to say Lonesome Dove.
Okay.
Or as far as TV goes, I live in Archer City, Texas, so I'm live in the home of Larry McMurtry.
There you go.
So if I don't say that, they'll throw me out of town.
Yeah, they will. Well, what do you think of Across the Wide Missouri?
As far as the Western film goes, I got to say The Searchers.
Good choice. What do you think of Across the Wide Missouri?
No, I mean, I love The Mountain Man. I love Jeremiah Johnson, which I can turn the sound off and tell you exactly what they're saying, much to my wife's chagrin and dismay that I do that. But I've always loved John Wayne, and that's my favorite movie of his.
Well, he's the best.
Most excellent. Will Emmerich, we are done. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. A real pleasure talking with you,
sir.
I love talking with fellow living historians.
Well, I appreciate everything you guys are doing to help keep the West alive.
Thank you. Thank you.
We need that more than anything right now.
By golly, we certainly do. Next time we get together on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West, movie Saturday, out at the White Stallion Ranch just north of Tucson, we're going to be talking about 21st century Westerns, Bunkers Uncovered, a plethora of them. And so we're going to be talking about that. So that's it for this edition of Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, Todd Roberts with you. Thank you so much.
78, 79, 80, and keep your darn fingers out of the trap.
Thanks for listening to Emil Franzi's Voices of the West.